From The Nation magazine, this is Start Making Sense. I'm John Wiener. Later in the show, some news about Haiti. Amy Willens will report. But first, abortion rights victories in some surprising places. Katha Pollitt will explain in a minute. Ever since the Supreme Court abolished constitutional protection for abortion at the end of June, activists have been fighting in the states to protect abortion rights where possible, to expand abortion rights where that's possible. And they've had some remarkable success in some surprising places, at least in the short run. For comment, we turn to Katha Pollitt. Of course, she's a poet, essayist, and award-winning columnist for The Nation. She also writes for The New Yorker, The Atlantic, and The New York Times. Her most recent book is Pro: Reclaiming Abortion Rights. Katha, welcome back.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Well, our story begins not in the deep blue abortion rights strongholds like California or New York, but in Kansas, where Trump in 2020 got 56% of the vote. Joe Biden got 42. Abortion rights were on the ballot there on a straight yes or no vote in the first week of August. Remind us what happened.
Well, it was quite remarkable, to the surprise of people just reading about it in the newspaper, but not so much people on the ground. Voters decided 59% to 41% to keep the right to abortion in the state constitution. Great.
You know, we've said that for 20 years, the country has been about at least 60% pro, 40% anti, but I never quite realized it would be the same in Kansas as nationwide, because we think of it as such a red state. So this means that lots of Republicans, as well as lots of independents, voted to keep abortion rights in the state constitution.
Yeah, but if I could just make one little intervention here, the figures you cited of 60 and 40, it all depends on how you ask the question. When you ask the question, should abortion be banned? Very few people. It gets like 18% in some polls. It's all about the phrasing. Are you pro-life? Are you pro-choice? Should it always be, you know, should it sometimes be banned? And it's very hard to pin this down. But this Kansas thing is really great. And I want to tell you a little bit about how that success came about. They ran, the pro-abortion rights people, ran a brilliant campaign. They talked about libertarian values. Do you want the government telling you what to do? They talked about extreme situations of health, women's health and life. They talked about rape and incest. They did, in fact, all the things that people like me have been saying, no, you shouldn't focus on all that. Most abortions are not because of rape, incest, or life of the woman. They're for social and economic and personal reasons. They didn't go there. And that in Kansas was the right thing to do. And I congratulate them. You can see some of these ads on YouTube, and they're really brilliant.
And then came Nebraska, right next door to Kansas, where Trump got 59 and Joe Biden got 39% in 2020. What happened in Nebraska? Remind us.
Well, people thought Nebraska would certainly be up there banning abortion any minute. The Republican governor condemned the state legislators, most of whom are Republicans, for refusing to convene a special session of the state's they only have one chamber in their legislature. So refusing to convene a special session to make abortion illegal after 12 weeks. They fell three votes short of the number needed to convene this session. That means that 69 legislators in Nebraska, more than two-thirds of the legislature, oppose making abortion illegal after 12 weeks. So that's really good.
And it's the direct fallout from Kansas.
It's the direct fallout from Kansas. See, Kansas, I think, has given people courage, because we're in our lazy way. We just assume that, you know, ordinary Americans are anti-abortion and they're religious, you know, extremely religious and all like that, and that they can't make fine distinctions. For example, I think abortion is wrong, but I don't think it should be banned. I think everyone gets to decide for themselves. That's a very common position, but it is not one that gets a lot of attention.
Yeah, and you're right about the libertarian case for abortion rights being so important in Kansas. People like us are very reluctant to tell people we want to keep government off our backs and out of our lives. But for a lot of people, this is a very good reason to keep abortion legal.
Well, the pro-choice movement has been saying for years, you know, you don't want a policeman in your bedroom. You don't want politicians in your womb, up there in your womb, unless you invite them or give birth to them, I suppose. But it's true. That libertarianism is a very deep strand in the American personality and mindset, and sometimes it works in favor of people actually having individual rights.
Planned Parenthood and the ACLU and their state partners have brought a series of lawsuits in state courts arguing that state legislatures have violated those states' constitutions in banning abortion or expanding restrictions on abortion. And the courts have sided with Planned Parenthood and the ACLU in some, again, surprising places. Let's run down some of them. Montana is a place you wouldn't expect the courts to be siding with Planned Parenthood and the ACLU.
Yeah, the Supreme Court of Montana ruled unanimously last Tuesday in blocking new state laws that restrict abortions. And those new laws would ban abortions after 20 weeks. And get this, prohibit the mail delivery of abortion pills for earlier term procedures. So that's really good news. I mean, the mail is going to be very important moving forward. And you definitely do not want people opening your mail to see what's in it.
And we say the mail is very important. You do not mean M-A-L-E.
No. No, the mail is very important because that is how people will be able to get abortion pills.
And the argument of Planned Parenthood of Montana was that the state's constitution guarantees equal protection as well as privacy. Equal protection certainly is an interesting argument to make as a defense of abortion rights.
Well, equal protection was offered to the Supreme Court in the Roe case. You know, you can't make women suffer in a way that men don't have to suffer. This is against, you know, basic fairness of the laws. The Supreme Court was offered that as a reason, and they didn't. They went with privacy instead. Of course, Ruth Bader Ginsburg thought that it would have been better to place it under equal protection, but that didn't happen. So it's an argument that's been around forever, and it's a very good argument.
So Montana has at least delayed this case from going to trial. There will be a trial eventually in Yellowstone County, Montana. And right next door to Montana, the Wyoming courts have also sided with Planned Parenthood recently.
Yeah. So this is interesting. The judge said, a woman, mind you, the legislature cannot pass a discriminatory law on the basis of sex that restricts the constitutionally protected right to make one's own healthcare decisions. And that case will eventually be decided by the state Supreme Court.
And North Dakota is another state where there's a court battle going right now. It has one abortion clinic in Fargo, North Dakota, the Red River Women's Clinic. They're prepared to move across the state line to Moorhead, Minnesota, just over the bridge on the other side of the Red River. But right now, they don't have to move. Tell us about North Dakota.
So in North Dakota, courts have temporarily blocked trigger bans. A trigger ban is the activation of a law that was originally passed before Roe. So it's been, you know, held in abeyance, but now it can come back. And some of these laws go back, you know, many, many decades. So temporarily, abortions can continue. But you're right that the the Red River Women's Clinic in Fargo is moving across the state line.
And now it's time for your Minnesota moment. That's news from my hometown of St. Paul that you won't get from Sean Hannity. A Minnesota judge recently struck down several of the state's longstanding abortion restrictions as unconstitutional, including a 24-hour waiting period and a requirement that all abortions be administered by doctors. This comes as Minnesota providers are preparing for increased demand from patients from surrounding states, North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Wisconsin, that are expected to pass new restrictions or to ban the procedure outright. This ruling overturned the requirement of informed consent for minors, overturned a 24-hour waiting period, overturned two-parent notification mandate for minors. And this decision also reversed the requirement that abortions after the first trimester be performed in a hospital. This has been your Minnesota Moment, a special feature of this broadcast. So these are the court cases. There's a caveat here.
Yeah, the caveat here is that a lot of these cases will be settled in the wrong way eventually.
Eventually.
Some of this is, I fear, going to be temporary. And further caveat is, I mean, it's just such a terrible moment, because what's going to happen is that the people who need abortions, who live in states that ban abortions, or where they can't get abortions for one reason or another, are all going to be descent, or as many of them as can get there, are going to be descending on the states where abortion is legal, which are not really set up to handle this sudden vast increase in patients. So what's already happening is that it takes longer to get an appointment. And that means you're later on in your pregnancy. You could go over from the first trimester, where abortion is about $500, into the second trimester, where it goes up in price every week. So there is really no way, much as you're trying to spin this as you know, good news. It's mostly bad news. I mean, Kansas is good news, but it's probably not going to be the end of the story, even in Kansas. I mean, a lot of it depends on, you know, who's in charge. And that's why the midterms will be so important. I just can't stress that enough, that who is in the state legislature, who the governor is, who the district attorneys are, even who's on the zoning commission, these things all matter enormously. They matter for whether your vote gets counted going forward, but they also matter for abortion rights.
And I'm very glad you mentioned district attorneys, because that is also the next battleground. If the states ban abortion, which lots of them are doing now and will be doing as soon as they can, there are still the cities, almost all of which are under Democratic control. And that becomes the final line of defense here. And the first one to take action here is Austin, the first city to decriminalize enforcement of the state law banning abortion. The Austin City Council has directed the Austin Police Department to, quote, deprioritize investigations of criminal offenses related to abortion. This prevents the police from devoting their resources and personnel to prioritizing prosecution of those who support abortions and those who receive abortions. And now lots of other states are doing the same thing. Dallas and San Antonio have city councils and district attorneys that have done the same thing. So have Nashville, Atlanta, and New Orleans. There are nearly 90 district attorneys across the country, including at least 5 in Texas, who have vowed not to prosecute abortion-related violations of state law. So yeah, vote for progressive district attorneys.
It's very important.
Okay, that's our abortion rights report for this week. Now for something completely different. You are also writing for TheNation.com this week about the attack on Salman Rushdie. Last Saturday, of course, he was attacked on stage in upstate New York and stabbed repeatedly. The attacker was arrested and charged with attempted murder. Terrible story. I know you've been thinking about this a lot.
I have. And, you know, I just wish Christopher Hitchens were here. you know, because he was such a vigorous defender of freedom of speech. And he was, you know, such a stout atheist, which came in handy in the case of Salman Rushdie. And I just think he would have had no, well, he did when the fatwa was announced in 1989. This has been going on for a really long time. He was just very uncompromising about how, whether you should curtail your speech in order to placate angry religious people. And he thought you shouldn't do that. And I agree with him.
My favorite book of Rushdie's is the one he wrote about his life in hiding. It's called Joseph Anton, A Memoir, which was his name underground. The British police said he had to have a code name. So he picked the name Joseph Anton. The book starts the day he received the news about being sentenced to death by Khomeini. And it names all the people who supported him, all the people who helped him, and all the people who didn't. I've just gotten to the part where Margaret Drabble offers him her summer house. And of course, Katha, I'm sure you would offer him your summer house if he needed it.
Oh, definitely. We have a spare bedroom. You know, it was really interesting that, I mean, he got a tremendous amount of support, of course, in 1989 and after, but there were plenty of famous people who more or less blamed him and attacked him. For example, Roald Dahl, who was, I guess, nobody's idea of a nice guy. he called him a dangerous opportunist. And John le Carré, after Rushdie wrote an unflattering review of one of John le Carré's books, John le Carré just really went on the warpath. And he said, you know, well, I just don't know whether you should be able to, you know, burn a Quran and not have any consequences. I mean, this is not burning a Quran in the first place. This is a novel which has some dream passages that the Ayatollah Khomeini decided were blasphemous. The Ayatollah Khomeini, interestingly enough, never read the book. This is something I have found to be true of most people who attack a book or a movie or a work of art. They don't know what they're talking about, and they don't care. This was all a political move on the part of Iran to
shore up support after losing the Iran-Iraq war.
Yeah, that, and also just to change the subject, basically. And also once you bring in religion, people stop thinking. That is the truth.
Once you bring in religion, people stop thinking. Katha Pollitt, you can read her new piece about the attack on Salman Rushdie at thenation.com, where she writes regularly about abortion rights. Katha, thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me, John. It was really fun.
Now we have a Haiti update from Amy Willens. She's written extensively about the Middle East, California, and the Trump family, but she's best known for her work on Haiti, most recently the award-winning book Farewell Fred Voodoo. She's a longtime contributing editor at The Nation, and she's the former Jerusalem bureau chief of The New Yorker. She's a 2020 Guggenheim Fellow, and she teaches in the literary journalism program at UC Irvine. Amy, welcome back.
Thanks a lot, John.
Well, we always start by reminding our listeners why we care about Haiti. And it's not just because it's a desperately poor country, but because Haiti had the first slave revolution in the 1790s, the largest slave uprising since Spartacus. It established the world's first black republic. And Haiti has been punished by France and the United States pretty much ever since. You say you were astonished by one piece of news about Haiti that came out last week. Tell us about that.
It was an unasked for statement by the OAS, unsigned, but by the Secretary General, Luis Almagro, who wrote, it was a mea culpa, basically, saying that the international community was responsible for the decline over the last 20 years of Haiti.
Do you agree with this assessment?
Oh, yeah. We've been saying this forever. All you had to do was watch the international community ignoring every government or controlling every government in Haiti for the past 30 years to know that they were largely responsible for what's been happening in Haiti since the earthquake.
And what is life like right now for ordinary Haitians in Port-au-Prince?
It's just so bad. So many of my friends who have money to get out have gotten out. Very responsible people and the entire professional class are sort of sitting it out in Miami so they don't get killed. But the place is being run, the capital, Port-au-Prince, being run by the gangs. There are 200 operating gangs in Haiti, estimated. Now, some of these are a little like, you know, your hometown gang, your neighborhood gang, and then some of them are running gangs so big that they can close off all routes into the capital. They close down the gasoline depot at the port and have done. They could close the airport at any given moment if they decided to do that. They took over the Justice Ministry and burned all the files in the Justice Ministry. They burned down two courts. They threatened to come down to the presidential palace. Of course, there's not a president in Haiti right now. There's just a de facto prime minister whom the international community, thank you, international community, appointed basically to be the replacement for the assassinated Jovenel Moïse, who was killed a little more than a year ago, with no security force to defend him and whose assassination has not even really been prosecuted yet because the suspects are just sitting in a jail in Haiti.
So the OAS admits the international community is responsible for the destruction of Haiti. Who does the OAS think can fix Haiti?
Well, it's a weird kind of document, this statement. It says none of the branches of government is working. None of the ministries is working. And then it says that really the international community is responsible for this breakdown. And then it advises the international community is the, as Trump would say, to paraphrase, that they alone can fix it. Now that they've wrecked it, Haiti's supposed to turn to them to fix it. They will have to be involved in the solution for Haiti. And that is a terrible thing. These gangs, they're there because they're part of the country and how the country has been organized to work in the past couple of decades, that they are runners and transshippers, salesmen, and wholesalers for the international drug cartels in Latin America coming through to the United States. Some of those drugs are sold in Haiti itself, but a lot of it is transshipped. And this has been going on 30 years, but it's much worse. And there's the turf wars among these gangs. One recent turf war was in the very big shanty town of Cité Soleil, which was developed by Papadoc François Duvalier in the, I think, 60s or 70s to get all of the homeless people out of Port-au-Prince for some festival he was having. So he pushed them all into this place, and now it's huge. It's a huge shanty town, 200,000 people, maybe more, slightly reduced recently by gang turf battles within it, in which about 475 men, women, and children were destroyed in this fight. So that's what it's like to live in Haiti. It's not good. And the gangs are also run by various political factions. There have been actual human rights reports showing which government officials at the time were involved in various gang massacres. So to fix the gangs essentially is to fix the corruption in society, because people use these gangs to strong arm their rivals and for money. I mean, it's all about money in the end.
So who can defeat the gangs? There's the Haitian police. There's the Haitian military.
Yeah. I think it was 2021. The Haitian police attempted into another shantytown called Village de Dieu, the Village of God, which is run by one of the gangs. And they go in, this not big enough group of National Police in two tanks or armored cars. They were just taken out by the gang. The gangs have more men. They're probably paying better salaries than the National Police, probably paying more regularly than the National Police. And they took these guys, young men, exactly like themselves, these policemen, and they almost literally ripped them to shreds. They killed, I think, some. They burned their tanks. They stole their arms. They paraded bodies on video. It was hideous. They're very brazen, the gangs.
Yeah. So this is why the OAS and lots of other people say this is a job for the American military. The American military has been there before. They have the capability. They are, in fact, we've read their strategy is already drafted to restore order to Port-au-Prince. This would be justified as a humanitarian intervention.
But it's dangerous. That's the thing. I know the U.S. Army could defeat these gangs. Could, definitely. But if you come in too great a force, you're going to kill a lot of civilians. The gangs have many supporters among the citizenry. And if you just go in full blast, full bore, you're going to kill a lot of grannies and babies. But the other thing is these people are very well armed. These people have riot gear and bulletproof jackets and everything in the gangs. So it's not like the way the U.S. used to think of going into Haiti. Oh, we'll send in the Marines. It'll be a bunch of guys in blue jeans and, you know, guayaberas who will have to kill, arrest, whatever, take down. And it'll be fine. We'll just shoot whoever we need to. No, we could actually, with boots on the ground, sustain casualties. And I think that President Biden is fully aware of that and of what that's going to look like.
Of course, historically, there's been one alternative to the American military intervening, and that is the UN. The UN sent a peacekeeping force in, 2004, and they were there for like 15 years. Remind us how the UN peacekeeping force turned out for Haiti.
They were the biggest gang. They have a lot of series of sexual molestations in their record. They shot a lot of people in their shanties, and they did keep a relative peace during the time they were there. And that's why people like Almagro say the UN left, that was a mistake, they should have stayed. But they were part and parcel of the inability of Haiti to grow its own judicial forces, to grow its own police forces, to take control itself. But also the UN brought in something much, much worse than all of that, which is cholera. Maybe 10,000, maybe 20,000 people, I can't even remember the number, died in the initial cholera epidemic. And then since then, they've been dying too. There was no cholera in Haiti before the UN came in and befouled, literally with their excrement, the main river of Haiti. So anytime you went to the river to wash your laundry, you got cholera, you brought it back to your village, everybody got cholera, people died, so no one could deal with it.
You say that the Haitian police have recently introduced a new tactic that has had a kind of success.
Looking at the number of arrests and especially of killings of gang leaders and gang members in the past month, someone is operating who's different from what has been happening before. There is a force that's been sent in to advise the Haitian National Police, maybe even helping them, assisting them, working with them hand in hand. I don't know. They have gone out on sort of extrajudicial shooting sprees against the gangs, and they've killed, they'll kill nine at the same time. In the kind of situation where we ask of the U.S. government when it drone kills some leading terrorist figure, we say, did you have to kill 20 people along with that guy? Who are they? Were they all really little terrorists, or were there some excess people there? You kind of wonder here, too, were they all gang people? But they have had some successful engagements with the gangs. They've actually been able to say, we killed this one. And the nickname of that gang leader.
You've suggested the reason why Joe Biden is unlikely to order a U.S. military intervention to defeat the gangs and restore order in Haiti, especially before the midterms. But after that, do you think he might?
It could happen that Biden will just feel that the boat people coming into Florida is not good for the next election. Boat people from Haiti, it alienates the Cuban conservatives even more than they're alienated already. And, you know, he may feel that we have to go in for some reason because Haiti is not controlling itself to our satisfaction. Because too many Haitians are dying on the ground because of these gangs. You just can't predict completely what the Biden administration is going to do post-midterm or pre. I mean, they could go in before, but I would be very surprised to see them have that kind of courage. On the other hand, they left Afghanistan, but not this soon before the midterms.
One other story that didn't get any coverage. I saw that Haiti's prime minister, Ariel Henry, came to Los Angeles, our town, in June for the Summit of the Americas, and that he gave a speech and he met with American diplomats. I saw one photograph online where he looked splendid, really beautiful suit, but somehow this didn't really make the news at all.
He's a very handsome guy, actually, and very tall, very imposing, perfect presidential material. Unfortunately, he is a de facto prime minister and by trade a neurosurgeon, which is not doing him that much good right now because no one's coming to his operating table to be operated on. So yes, he did come to LA for the Summit of the Americas. He gave a speech. It didn't really propose any changes in what he's been not doing. You know, he met with American diplomats. Well, he does that in Haiti also. So yeah, he came to LA. That's kind of cool. I should have tried to interview him here, but I failed to because he's de facto and he doesn't do anything. So
the acting de facto prime minister does nothing. Haiti needs a government that does a lot. What should this government be?
There is a group that was originally called the Commission for a Haitian Solution to the Crisis. And they put together really a plan for an interim government leading to elections at the Hotel Montana in Port-au-Prince, and therefore have had the very confusing name to Americans of the Montana Group or the Montana Accord. And everybody thinks, what? They came to Montana? No, they did not come to Montana. They went uptown. So their plan is a very carefully laid out and possibly impossible plan to follow, but a carefully laid out plan of this group of many, many groups. It's an umbrella group for about 200 groups around the country, peasant groups, labor groups, human rights groups, political groups, grassroots groups, shantytown groups, and a nice sprinkling of the Haitian elite, whom we've always seen the more progressive among them. And they all speak English, those people at the top of this fabulous group of fantastic Haitians. So they can relate to the embassy and everything. And they've had talks with the embassy, but it is a big group and no one knows who will rise to the top of it. But their hope is to install an interim government, which they've already elected. There's a president of this group, Fritz Jean is his name, and to move toward reestablishing a judicial process, a process of justice.
What to do about the gang members is, of course, we've said, the most urgent problem. There are these assassination squads that are trying to kill off the leaders of the most violent and dangerous gangs, but there's many hundreds of gang members, and what's going to happen to them?
These are largely young men of the shantytowns. Now, I've said already, they're not necessarily running themselves, these gangs. They're being run by other stronger sections of Haitian society. So what do you do with kids from the shantytown who don't really have much future in Haiti, less and less as they destroy the society more and more, to be honest? These are 16-year-old to 22-year-olds. Some of the gang leaders are in their 30s. They're people, many of them are people who've left the police because the police didn't offer enough. They offered a weapon, the police offered a salary. Sometimes the salary was paid, sometimes it wasn't. It was very low. There were no benefits. It's very different in a gang. In a gang, you get paid a lot. You're risking a lot. You get paid in kind sometimes, in drugs. You get paid money. It's more money than the police get, and it's pretty regular as long as you do what is necessary, what you're called on to do. So to integrate them, the, say, Montana group, should it come to power by some incredible fortune, would have to offer them real jobs with real money and a future. That would have to be underwritten probably by the international community, that kind of money that you would need to reintegrate all the members of the 200 gangs in Haiti plus more, and start dealing with the shanty towns themselves in general. So you have to give these people a reason to want to live longer and make a steady income instead of live shorter and make a lot of money. And you have to get their guns away from them, to get a gun away from a child, say a fake gun away from a small child. I've dealt with three male children. It's very difficult to get a big real gun away from a big teenage kid. Is really, really hard. You have to convince them they're going to go on living without that gun and that they're going to have a way to live a decent life after that. And by decent, I mean a life not just bearable, but with maybe a little nice thing here and there, the way we have in our lives. They would like that. It's going to be a hard row to hoe. Do you think they can get out from under these gangs?
Well, the IRA was disarmed. The IRA is a much better organized
army. Hierarchical, but it's a hierarchical army.
It's a hierarchical army with a long history. And if their leaders say, we've signed this.
I mean, I think it can be done, but you have to talk to the people who are running the gangs. Now, they all know who's running the gang. As I always like to say about Haiti, the top people know everything that's happening. You just have to pull it out of them and they won't tell reporters. But they know who to talk to. And maybe if you can convince those people, but you know, those people, some of them are hardened criminals.
The LA gang truce was organized basically by reformed OGs, original gangsters, older survivors who could see that this really wasn't much of a life.
Yeah, but you see, in the LA gangs, this was a community preying on itself.
Yeah.
So it was gang wars inside the ghetto preying on each other. This is a whole country. So these people are not preying on each other, although to an American, they might all look the same. They're preying on the political class. It's like if the Crips were assassinating the mayor, if the Crips went into the courthouse downtown and took it over and burned it down, that's what's happening. So it's harder to deal with, and it's more important.
Amy Willens, she wrote about Haiti most recently for The Nation in a piece titled "The OAS Admits Culpability in the Destruction of Haiti." You can read it online at thenation.com. Amy, thanks for talking with us today.
You're welcome, John.
Start Making Sense, a podcast from The Nation magazine, is co-produced by the LA Review of Books and recorded in Los Angeles at our Blythe Avenue studios. Renee Reynolds is our associate producer. Alan Minsky is our producer. Ludwig Hurtado is our executive producer. D.D. Guttenplan is editor of The Nation. Bhaskar Sunkara is president of The Nation. And Katrina Vandenhoevel is publisher and editorial director of The Nation. Our theme music is from Barcelona Afrobeat, licensed by Creative Commons. You can find out more about Start Making Sense at thenation.com and subscribe to Start Making Sense on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm John Wiener. Thanks for listening.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.